This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Konnikova was born in Moscow and grew up in the United States. She writes the weekly literary site column for Scientific American and formerly wrote the popular psychology blog Artful Choice for Big Think. She graduated from Harvard University, where she studied psychology, creative writing and government. She also holds an MPhil in psychology and an MA in political science from Columbia, where she is currently studying for a doctorate in psychology. Maria Konnikova's first book is Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. So Maria, thanks for joining us on Little Atoms today.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I guess first of all, let's talk about Sherlock Holmes and where you first came across it. How did you first become interested in him?
Well, I was about 8 years old or so, and my dad had this tradition every Sunday night. He would read us stories before bed, and we'd gather in the living room next to the fireplace. We always had a fire going, leather armchair. He even smoked a pipe. And one of these stories was Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. It was this big crimson volume with all the stories in it. And so that was my first introduction to the detective, and it really made such an impression on me, especially one story, A Scandal in Bohemia. The opening of it just stayed with me for my whole life, really. And that's the famous exchange where Sherlock Holmes asks Dr. Watson how many steps lead up to 221B Baker Street. Watson doesn't know. And Holmes says, well, that's the difference between us. You only see. I both see and observe. And when I was little, I didn't quite understand what he was saying, but I could sympathize with Watson completely. I had no idea how many steps there were going anywhere, and it shocked me. I was like, oh my god, if Sherlock Holmes asked me, I wouldn't know. And so I started counting steps everywhere I went, and trying to memorize the number, you know, missing the point entirely. But it resonated, and it really kind of stayed with me through the years, and I found myself returning to it many years later, and realizing just how striking of a point it was, this difference between seeing and observing. And that's really what ended up inspiring the book.
So, as you just stated, you know, you've carried on your interest in Sherlock Holmes into your adult life. I am a massive fan of Sherlock Holmes, to begin with, Holmes obsessive, and I do this radio show about science and rationalism. What is it that's appealing about Holmes to our view of the world?
I think one thing that we don't really, or at least many people don't realize and don't appreciate about Sherlock Holmes, is just how accessible his methodology is. He isn't a fictional creation in the same sense as some other fictional detectives, because he's based on a real character. Mm-hmm. The inspiration behind him is Dr. Joseph Bell, Conan Doyle's mentor at the University of Edinburgh, who was a physician and whose methods of observation and deduction really were the inspiration behind this character. And so not only does Holmes come to these brilliant realizations, but he also explains how he got there. And the reasoning is such that we also have that same reaction that Dr. Watson says, you know, by God, I could do this myself. It's also simple once you explain it. But that really is the case. You really can use these very accessible steps to learn to think better, more methodically. And obviously we're not works of fiction, so it might not always work out quite as neatly, but the principles apply.
Well, I was going to say, as Watson often finds out, actually, it isn't that easy. It doesn't come naturally. It is something that needs to be worked at. And so that leads us on then to the book, Mastermind. So tell us briefly what the idea behind the book is.
The idea behind the book is that we can look at Holmes's explanations and the way he acts, the way he solves cases, how he speaks to Watson, you know, all of this information that Conan Doyle provides, and we can use it to learn to maximize our own minds so that we start learning to apply some of these own principles to our own thoughts. And so that we begin to approach the world in more of a Sherlockian fashion, less of a Watsonian fashion. Mm-hmm. And I do set up this juxtaposition in the book between Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, which I think Conan Doyle did for me, by creating Watson as this perfect kind of counterweight to Holmes's rationality, to Holmes's approach to problem solving. Watson really exemplifies our brain in its natural state, the way that we normally approach problems, which is, as I began by saying, the difference between seeing and observing, between this kind of mindless as you go, just letting the world kind of pass you by and without really interacting and stopping to make a conscious effort to take it all in, and mindfulness, which is observation, which is an approach that really is in the present moment and takes advantage of all of your resources and focuses your attention, your concentration on what there is in front of you, so that you know that there are 17 steps leading up to 221B Baker Street.
We'll have a look at those, the Watson system and the home system, a bit more closely in a moment. Starting into the book, you started off with a chapter that's entitled, has a great name, The Scientific Method of Thought, and this is a show that's often about the scientific method, so I think we should sort of elaborate on what we mean by the scientific method of thought.
Sure. So I think it's, let me just first take a step back to underscore when Conan Doyle was writing.
Okay.
And he was writing at the turn of the 19th century, where all of these revolutions in science were happening at the same time. The discovery of tuberculosis and germs and bacteria, and the discovery of x-rays, the birth of psychology. You know, you had William James in the United States, Sigmund Freud in Vienna. I mean, this was just a time where science was everywhere and was being applied to everything. And so I think it's only natural that Conan Doyle, who was trained in science and who was a doctor by training, would use some of the same scientific methodology in the detective that he created. And it goes back to, really, the scientific method as it's used anywhere. So you begin by just this groundwork understanding of yourself, your own mind, your own quirks, kind of your own biases, how your mind thinks just normally, how you normally see the world. This is akin to a scientist kind of surveying the landscape and trying to understand what's already known in the field, you know, what's going on. And then you observe. So you make certain that you know, well, what are, now that I know kind of what the landscape is, what are my goals and what do I want to observe? What kind of information do I want to take in that will help me frame a problem and understand what I'm dealing with? And in science, it's very clear, you know, you gather observations from work that's been done before you, and then you create this hypothesis. And as that applies to the mind, this is either Holmes creating a hypothesis, hypotheticals for the case, you setting goals for yourself, you set a problem that you want to work on, and then that's exactly what you do. Then you experiment. And experimentation in science is very clear what that means. But in terms of the human mind, I see experimentation as this imaginative moment where you really have to work with all of your observations and create something new. It's create something that hasn't existed before. And people don't, I think people underappreciate just how important imagination is to the scientific method because they think of it as something that's very dry, very sciencey. But really, if you think of all of the great thinkers, all of the great scientists, all of the great discoveries, they all had to imagine things that never existed. You know, Einstein, Feynman, these are all great thinkers who really valued intuition and imagination and understood just how marginalized it was becoming in the world. Then finally, you deduce or conclude. You see, okay, you know, now that I've worked through all of this, what makes sense? What are the possibilities that I haven't eliminated? And then once you've done that, you can reassess what you did at the beginning in light of your new findings. So were you right? Were you wrong? You don't have to be right or wrong because you might not have known really how it would turn out, but you've now learned all of this new information. And so you might have to go back to that first observational stage again. That's the other thing about the scientific method. It's a circle. It never really stops because you're always learning. And that's also something that Sherlock Holmes teaches us about the mind. You never know it all. There's always more to do. And once again, the great scientists, the great thinkers, they never stop at the end of an experiment. They realize that that then has to feed back into the beginning and inform their thinking from that point forward.
Let's have a closer look then at the two systems. You've given the two sides of the brain, the two ways of thinking, I guess, System Watson and System Holmes. So let's talk at the differences between those two. So System Watson, first of all, how would you describe that?
So System Watson is, if we're looking at the dual framework of thought, which is really the way that most psychologists are leaning these days and have been since the late 90s. This is what Daniel Kahneman refers to as System 1, or what the psychologists Walter Mischel and Janet Metcalfe before him referred to as the HOT system, what Matt Lieberman referred to as the reflexive system. So this is really, this has been in the discourse for a number of years now. And it's the system that really is active most of the time. It doesn't take as many cognitive resources. And it's all about go, go, go. It's about heat. It's about reaction. And so a lot of times it ends up being biased because we don't stop to reflect. But on the other hand, a lot of times it ends up being right. It's a very efficient way for our brains to work because we don't have to be worried about what's going on there. If we took time all the time to worry about every single detail, we wouldn't get very far. We'd be too busy trying to debate everything. And so our brain is very smart when it's choosing to operate in System Watson a lot of the time.
You're really talking about the way that a lot of our processes work almost on automatic pilot.
Yes, so
things that we don't need to think about.
Yes.
Not necessarily at the deep level of things like breathing, but I mean even things that we do every day. If you take the same journey to work every day, then you'll notice a lot of the time that you don't remember how you got there.
Yes. And it's really hard to turn off that autopilot. And you might find yourself on autopilot when you don't really want to be on autopilot. I mean, sometimes I'm having a conversation with someone and I realize I've zoned out. It's a terrible feeling. You don't remember what they just said and you feel very rude asking. So this definitely, that is System Watson. And, you know, when I say it's go, 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 that's definitely another one of its characteristics. Holmes makes a jibe at Watson at some point. He says, "No, this isn't one of your cases, Watson. It's mental, not physical." And, you know, poor Watson, my heart cries out for him. But that really is the essential difference between System Watson and System Holmes. System Watson is much more physical, much more reactive, much more just on a level where we're not reflecting about it.
So System Holmes, then?
So System Holmes is the opposite. So since I started with Kahneman, this would be Kahneman's System 2. If we talk at the Metcalfe-Mitchell model, this is the cool system. And if we're talking at the Lieberman model, it's the reflective system. So these are all the characteristics of this system: cool, reflective, slow, deliberate, rational, detached. This is Sherlock Holmes taking a step back and observing, being mindful, really stopping to pause and to look and to consider what's going on. And the system tends to be much more reflective, it's much more accurate a lot of the time. It's also slower and it's also much more effortful. You can't do this on autopilot. You have to make a conscious effort to stop and think this way. And so you expend many more of your resources that way. Your cognitive capital, so to speak, gets used up when you're in System Holmes much faster than it would be in System Watson. So it's not efficient to be in System Holmes all the time. You kind of have to pick and choose your battles, but you have to realize, you know, what are the advantages and are the advantages worth what I know will be the trade-off, which is that I do have to slow down and I do have to process more, and it will be more effortful, so I certainly can't be thinking about anything else. I really have to pause to consider this.
So seeing that you've called these two the sort of parallel brain systems, System Watson and System Holmes, that's the point in the book. Let's have a look at a couple of examples of them in action. So if we go to A Study in Scarlet, the first Holmes story, let's talk about the actual meeting between Watson and Holmes. So talk us through that.
So this very famous encounter, first of all, was also based on Dr. Joseph Bell, when he was able to tell that a patient of his was a retired colonel who was just back from Barbados, I believe it was, in the Scottish Highlands. Colonel from the Scottish Highlands who was just come back from Barbados.
Well, how nice it would be if Barbados was in the Scottish Highlands.
I realized that there was a little bit of ambiguity there. And so when the two of them meet, and Holmes is able to say, "Watson, you know, you've just come from Afghanistan," this is the first time where he really shows Watson what his thought process is. And if you notice, it's hardest for him here to verbalize it because he's not used to doing it. For him, he's learned it so well that it's almost become the purview of System Watson, no longer System Holmes, because he doesn't have to think about it. It's become an intuition, but it's an expert intuition. It's something that he's spent thousands of hours and cases analyzing. And he takes these details from Watson that through experience he has learned matter and make a difference, and out of them he makes sure to create a complete picture. So for instance, you know, Watson is tan. You're in London. Tan doesn't really go well with London weather. So Watson was clearly somewhere else. He's been wounded. He's limping. Why would he be limping like that? It could be, you know, a congenital thing, but it doesn't seem like it is in the case of Watson. So clearly he might have been coming from a war. And these are the sorts of things, I won't go through the whole list, but these are the sorts of things that Holmes looks at when he decides to say, "Watson, you've come from Afghanistan." And the more he does it, as we get further into the stories, the better he becomes at it, because he learns to identify his thought process, the scientific method of the mind, for Watson, so that Watson can understand the methodology behind it. And I think that that helps Holmes become a better thinker, because he starts reflecting a little bit more on his methods, and then he can surpass himself. He can keep learning. Otherwise, he'd be too likely to plateau and to kind of stay at that level without really ever going to that to the next level. So this is a very important meeting, not just because it introduces our two protagonists, but also because it's the beginning of Holmes's ability to access how it is that he does what he does.
So let us then look at a contrasting incident, which is when Watson gets his first glimpse of Mary, the woman that will eventually become his wife. And How does he react?
Well, one of the things that characterizes Sherlock Holmes is his ability to detach himself from his emotions. I'm not going to say that he's cold, because he's not. I'm not going to say he doesn't feel emotions, because he does. What I think he's so wonderful at is feeling the emotion and then discounting the emotion, mm-hmm. saying, okay, I feel it, but I'm not going to let it bias the situation. I'm not going to let it influence my world perception or cloud my mind attic. And what Watson does is the exact opposite. He sees Mary, he's attracted to her, and right away everything is covered in this wonderful halo. He hasn't even heard her speak. Right away he's calling her saintly, he's calling her kind, he's imbuing her with all of these positive qualities, and he has no idea whether they're accurate or not. He's just drawn a picture because she's blonde, and I guess he has a thing for blondes, you know, she, for whatever reason, he's struck by her. And so then, right away, he loses his objectivity from the get-go. He's not going to judge her the same way as he would judge someone he found unattractive. And we get, in other cases, I don't write about a case of identity in my book, but in a case of identity, we see the opposite, where he's so incredibly mean to the heroine because she's ugly. He calls her ugly, he calls her fat, he calls her stupid. I mean, by God, he is really nasty. And Holmes is chivalrous and kind, and you can tell that she's not stupid. None of these things are true. You know, Watson is just very used to judging people based on appearances. You know, he clearly didn't take that don't judge the book by its cover thing seriously. And so with Mary, you see these two contrasting approaches. Do you let emotion cloud your judgment? Do you begin your observation? Do you begin your thought process from a biased point of view, which is really hard to remedy retroactively because we tend to reinforce our early biases? Or do we learn to recognize that we will be biased and that there are things that will bias us? So Holmes does recognize that Mary's pretty. He does notice all of the same things as Watson, but then he, in recognizing them and recognizing himself, recognizing him in this kind of meta-awareness, he makes it less likely that those things will in turn affect his judgment of Mary. Mm-hmm. And so it will be much more objective and Sherlockian in contrast to Watson's subjective Watsonian approach. And once again, you see that subjective system Watson, objective system Holmes duality.
Before we move on, I just want to look at a couple of terms for both of those ways of thinking, I guess. A way to describe the system Holmes, a way to describe the system Watson. So we've just been talking about Watson. So what Watson's just done there with his abiding love of blonde is something that's called priming. So tell us what priming means as a psychological term.
Priming is the idea that our environment primes or readies our mind. So you can think of it even as paint, you know. Mm-hmm. Why do you prime a wall? So that you can paint on it. And so something in the environment primes our mind to think a certain way. And primes our subconscious. If we're aware of them, they no longer have the same power over us. And in this case, Watson was clearly primed by something in Mary's looks. So he probably has some past associations with blondes, with whatever it is. I'm not sure what, we obviously don't know what exactly it is, but he has associations from past experience that then prime his mind to think in a certain way. But the prime could have been something like a coffee cup that had some sort of an image on it, or even just a coffee cup that he held. Because there's interesting work that shows that when we hold hot drinks, mm-hmm. we think of people as warmer. And when we hold icy drinks, I don't like that your glass has ice in it. That doesn't bode well for our interaction. You think of people as colder and less approachable. So things in the environment prime us all the time and make us more likely to interpret the world in certain ways and less likely to interpret them in others. Mm-hmm. So once again, in the case of Watson, something about Mary's appearance clearly primed him to think her.
So you mentioned when we're thinking in the system Holmes way that it's quite labour intensive, it's not something that can really do in short bursts. And another way of looking at that you talk about is, you know, the idea that it's, you have to be motivated to think like that. So let's talk about what difference being motivated to think makes.
Yeah, well, motivation is something that I think is underappreciated in the sense of it's incredibly important to basically everything in psychology. Mm-hmm. The more motivated you are, the better you are at whatever it is you've set out to do. So memory improves, concentration improves, performance improves on just about any measure. One of the things that I find very interesting is that most studies in psychology that try to compare across age, it's very difficult to make those meaningful because, in general, elderly adults who come into the lab are much more motivated mm-hmm. than college students because college students have nothing to prove to you. Elderly adults want to prove that they're still sharp, that they still have it. Mm-hmm. And and that makes him perform better. Motivation really gives you a performance boost. There's a study that shows that motivation affects IQ and SAT scores. I mean, you really see it almost across the board. And so what I mean to say that to think like Holmes, you need to be motivated, is if you have that desire and if you want to think like Sherlock Holmes, it will make your brain much more receptive to all of these inputs and all of these ways of thought and make you much better able to learn. You know, you will prime your brain in a sense to start thinking like Holmes. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're not motivated, if you're just like, why would I want to think like Sherlock Holmes? You're setting yourself up for failure. The mindset should really not be underestimated. And motivation can counteract so many negatives, so that, you know, that's why you have these wonderful underdog stories that we all love so much, because it shows motivation can really conquer a lot. It can't conquer all, obviously. We all have natural limitations, but it will help us get to those limitations much faster.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Maria Konnikova about Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. So, Maria, we're going to talk in the second part of the show about, well, Holmes calls it the brain attic. So let's talk about what we mean by the brain attic.
So for Sherlock Holmes, the brain attic is really the analogy for the human mind. How is it that we store information? How do we take that information in? How do we access that information once we've stored it? So you can think about it as a physical attic space, with the caveat that your brain attic is a little bit more flexible. It's not quite as finite as a physical attic in a house, which of course you can expand, but that'll take much more effort than it does to expand your mental brain attic. So you have this space up there, and you can make a decision about what you're going to put up there. So you can use it for just storing any old thing, putting any junk you want up there, because after all, it's an attic. There's lots of space in there. So you do this over the years. Once you walk up there and you realize, uh-oh, it's full. No more space. Don't have any room to put anything else up there. Oh, by the way, where did that box go that I put up here a few years ago? I have no idea. I can't find it. It's a complete mess. That's kind of the system Watson attic. That's what our normal approach to storing information is. What Holmes says is, let's realize that the attic is a finite space, that this is precious real estate, and let's be mindful about how we use it. Mm-hmm. So don't just put anything up there. Realize what you're putting up there. Say, hey, you know, do I want to put this bottle up there? Does it really go in my attic, or is this something that I can just recycle? Do I not really need it up there right now? Once you've decided that something is important enough to go into your brain attic, you start thinking about, okay, well then what is the most effective way to store it? Because I don't want to just throw it up there. First of all, I'll use my space much more rapidly, but secondly, I won't be able to find anything. And one of the things you need to remember about your brain attic is, if you can't find it, it might just not as well not be up there, because if you can't find it, you can't use it. Mm-hmm. And so Holmes says, you know, be really careful how you store things. Label them. If you're looking at the attic analogy, you know, put them in a file, put them in a box, and put as many labels on it as you possibly can. So what I mean by that is cross-reference. Do a constant inventory of your attic. Know what's already in there and be able to fit whatever you're learning into that framework and tie it to your existing base of knowledge. Because the more you do that, the more likely you are to remember it. What's more, the more vivid it is, the more likely you are to remember it. So do you have any sensory inputs that you can tie to this object? Are there any other tags, any emotional connections? What is going to help you remember it? And if it really, even though it might seem like it's very effortful, that's the only time you'll have to encode it. And every point of encoding is also a point of retrieval. So you're really only doing yourself a favor, because if it's worth remembering, then you want to make sure you remember it well.
So all the talk of a brain attic, a filing system, sounds metaphorical, but actually you talk in the book about how it's really turned out to be quite accurate. So let's talk a little bit about what research has been done into the formation and retention of memories and how they actually do fit into that metaphor.
Yeah, I think Conan Doyle was onto something when he did this, because our brain really is a very spatial thing. You know, we do remember things spatially. If you think about, you know, the attic, one of the ways that you can remember where you put something is by trying to visualize, mm-hmm. you know, okay, where did I put it? Because our brain is much better at visual storage. So in that respect, it's very accurate. But also in the way that we tag and encode and can then access things. So the attic, there are things that are closer to you that are easier to access. There are things that are further away that are more difficult to access. That's where memory works as well. So we can access certain things faster than we can others. And the more we access something, the easier it becomes, kind of the more it comes to the surface. It's more accessible if we're talking in the jargon of memory researchers. So accessibility increases with frequency. So the more we try to access something, the more likely we are to be able to access it. If we don't access it very frequently, then it will become harder for us to remember it as time goes on. And, you know, it can get dusty if you're looking at it from the attic metaphor, and if you're talking about actual brain research, it's just the connections, if we don't renew them, might go away. The other thing about it is, just as things might shift in a regular attic, you know, files might get mixed up, our memories aren't stable. So we might put out in one photo album, and when we get that same photo album out, some pictures have fallen out, some new stuff from somewhere else has come in. So our memories change, and what we think we remember may not be what actually happened. I mean, memory is incredibly malleable. And the odd thing is, the more often we access a memory, the more likely it is to change. Because if we change the telling of it, we will eventually change the storage of it. And it's just quite ironic that the more we access it, the less accurate and reliable it becomes. And so in that sense, it's a little bit more difficult to think about it in physical terms, unless you think about, you know, a picture fading, or, you know, the colors changing, maybe you becoming a little more hazy on what day it was if the picture didn't have the date properly labeled. So our memory is very fallible and very malleable. And in an attic, things get lost and things do change over time. And we do, just like we need to maintain an attic or it gets a little bit old and might start caving in a little bit, you know, rain damage, all that stuff. We need to really make sure that we're keeping up our memory. And research has shown that our brain does really work a lot on a use it or lose it type of thing. Things that we don't practice, things that we don't try to actively maintain, end up falling by the wayside. We probably will be able to repair that leak, just like we'll be able to pick up skills or memories that we've neglected, but it will just take a little bit of time. And if we keep neglecting it, then, you know, it'll rot through.
I want to talk about a couple of ways in which we process information. One of the ways, one of the sort of Holmesian ways of looking at the world, and the theme of this show, I guess, is take in all of the information that we take in skeptically and consider it as we do. I was really struck by this particular idea, which is, I mean, you mentioned it in the context of the psychologist Daniel Gilbert, but it's both Spinoza and William James had the same idea. And this is this idea that to process something, we have to believe in it, even if it's just for the split second that we think about it. So tell us what you mean by that, because it's fascinating.
Well, the example I use in the book, and it's an example that I find really striking, so I'm just going to use it again, is a pink elephant. In order to realize, when I say pink elephant, you have to picture a pink elephant. Your brain can't not picture it, because in order to realize that it can't exist, you first have to imagine it existing. So your brain is in this default true mode. Always. Any information, in order to be processed, has to be encoded the way it's told. So it has to be processed as true. Only then can you say, wait, pink elephant, that makes no sense. False. And so you've just made an act of correction to that information. But not everything is as striking as a pink elephant. A pink elephant is obviously not something that exists. But I can tell you something, and this is a study that's actually been done with almost this precise example. I just don't remember the name that was used. Let's call him Joe. If I tell you that Joe has no ties to the mafia, you once again have to process the statement, but you process the true, you know, the true statement, ties to the mafia. And so you might misremember it later on as Joe having ties to the mafia. And even if you don't misremember it, you might still think negatively of Joe, just because your brain had to make that association between Joe and the mafia in order to try to make sense of that statement. And we really have to make an effort to be skeptical. We have to make an effort to correct, because the natural sense is one of credulity. But, you know, people who are gullible, they're not doing anything wrong. They're just taking the brain's natural tendency to its extreme. They don't question. It's hard to question, and it's effortful. And often we don't, especially when we're busy, when we're cognitively busy, when we're doing other things, and this is some of the work that Gilbert does, we don't take the time to correct. Mm-hmm. And so then we can't remember who said what and whether there was a no in it or no, whether the elephant was pink or purple and whether he actually exists. And so we just assume that, oh yeah, that's right. And we leave it at that, and we end up with misinformation. It's stuck in our heads. Even if that misinformation was corrected for us in the real world, it's much more difficult to correct it internally and to keep that correction alive.
Really, a lot of this has got to do with, and this seems like such an obvious concept, but obviously it takes on a deeper meaning in the context of psychology and how we retain information. You talk about why it's important to pay attention.
Well, the world influences us whether we know it or not. So we can pay attention or we cannot pay attention. The effect on us will happen. So we are influenced by all of our senses all of the time, especially the sense of smell. And the sense of smell is called the invisible sense for a reason, because people tend to underappreciate it and not pay attention to it. So what happens? You smell coffee. You have some sort of association with coffee. All of a sudden, you're thinking certain things or you're thinking in a certain way. You didn't even realize you smelled coffee because you weren't paying attention, so you have no idea why you're thinking this way. If you are paying attention, you will have paid attention to the smell of coffee. Now, if you have those same associations, you will attribute them to the coffee. Now you'll know where that association comes from, so you won't misattribute it. Because if we don't know where something's coming from, we tend to misattribute it to other things. One of my favorite studies by the psychologists Schwartz and Clore looked at the effects of weather on mood. Mm-hmm. So they had people come in on rainy days, sunny days. You know, they didn't control the weather, but they just had people come in on a bunch of days. And they asked them to rate their happiness. And they realized there was an incredibly strong correlation between weather and mood. But if they were to ask them first what the weather was like, it disappeared because people realized that the weather must have some effect on how they're feeling. And this wasn't just mood in the moment. This was life satisfaction ratings. See, these big questions about, you know, how happy are you with your life, with your marriage? You know, people were happier on sunny days than they were on rainy days. But the second that you can make the proper attribution, the effect disappears. Mm-hmm. And if we're not attentive, if we don't pay attention, we're always making incorrect attributions, because it doesn't mean that these effects don't exist. And the other, I think, reason it's important to pay attention is that otherwise, I mean, and this seems simple, and yet we do it all the time, including, by we, I mean me. When we don't pay attention, we miss things. Not only, we don't know the number of proverbial steps to 221B Baker Street. I say proverbial because the steps can be anything for you. Someone might say, hey, did you see that dog or whatever it was? Wasn't that great? And you didn't even realize you passed a dog. Mm-hmm. You know, you miss a lot of the world. And when you do this in your work, you're missing a lot. When you do this in your writing, when you do this in anything, you end up missing a lot of material, but we still do it.
So we talked in the first half about the Watsonian way of doing a lot of stuff that you've done before on sort of autopilot. We've just talked now about the importance of paying attention and the fact that it's quite easy to go through your life not paying attention. So we come to this is quite a technical term, something called the default mode network, the DMN is the abbreviation of the brain. So those things are related, I guess. Is that what we're sort of talking about
there? Yeah, so Marcus Reichel identified this mode of thought originally, and it's the connections that are active when our brain is in its so-called resting state. And I say so-called because I can't do quotes on a podcast, because our brain is really not resting. It's incredibly active. we're not consciously doing anything. But this mode is monitoring the environment constantly, both the internal and the external environment, to know if there's something that it has to respond to. What we do when we're mindful, when we observe in the Sherlockian kind of sense, when we're present, is we strengthen the connections between the different parts of the default mode network. We make it stronger. We also strengthen the connections between the default mode network and other attentional parts of the brain, parts of the brain devoted to attention. And that makes us more able to concentrate. So that's kind of this self-reinforcing cycle. The more we concentrate, the easier it becomes. Mm-hmm. And the more we're able to concentrate, so the more we think like Holmes, the easier it is to think like Holmes, and the less we have to think about thinking like Holmes. So it almost switches system Holmes into the way that system Watson normally operates, retraining it, which is pretty cool. It also makes us more creative, because there's new work, by new I mean in the last few months, that shows that strength in the default mode network is related to creativity. People with stronger connections there are better at telling vivid stories, at imagining more vivid futures. I mean, it's really interesting that there's a connection there as well. It makes us better able to monitor our internal states to know how we're feeling and better able to monitor our external environment. So it comes with all sorts of benefits, all from just being mindful, paying attention, observing, and all from this default mode network.
You spend some time then in the book looking at ways in which we can train ourselves to pay attention better. Some of the section headings of the book are sort of bullet points. You say be selective, be objective, be inclusive and be engaged. And so I'd like to look at a couple of those, but again in reference to some of the Sherlock Holmes stories that you use as an example in the book. So let's talk about how we can be more objective. And to do that, tell us what happens in The Adventure of the Priory School.
So in The Adventure of the Priory School, let me start there. A star pupil goes missing. And by star pupil, I don't mean just academically. He's kind of their star. He's the son of the most wealthy patron of the school. And along with him, the German tutor also goes missing. And no one can find the boy. No one can find the tutor. Everyone assumes that the tutor somehow abducted the boy. That's the premise of the investigator. Sherlock Holmes is called in. And what Sherlock Holmes realizes right away is that the investigators aren't looking at the facts. Mm-hmm. They've from the very beginning begun to tell a story with them. What they don't realize is the objective evidence, so be objective, is that there's a student missing, period. There's also a teacher missing, period. Separate sentences. Mm-hmm. Right away they've put them into one and they've made a connection between them. The objective facts say no such thing. They just say two people missing. And Holmes realizes that. He says, well, that's all we know. We can't start telling a story about the escape because that's already subjectivity. You're interpreting mm-hmm. the facts. You're not just looking at the scene. And right away, that interpretation is affecting what you're looking at, how you're looking at it. That goes to the other point of selectivity. You know, it's influencing what and how you look. And so if you start from the objective premise, you will realize that you might need to look in different places, that you might need to consider different scenarios, because if the German master didn't abduct the boy, then maybe he was doing something else. And so he starts going through all of this, and he ends up being able to, without spoiling the story, find the missing tutor right away, even though he's pretty close to the school, and no one else could do that because they just assumed that he must be gone with the boy. And our brains do that all the time. We're always telling ourselves stories. We're always making these connections that there's no objective mm-hmm. reason for making. And so that be objective part is incredibly difficult, but it is the basis of good observation, and it is the basis of being able to complete the thought process successfully. Holmes would never be able to find the tutor if he had started with the same premise mm-hmm. Instead of with his objective assessment of the facts.
So how then, let's talk about how we can apply that to our own lives.
So whenever you see anything, or whenever you find yourself telling a story about anything, whenever you're doing anything, you can take a moment to try to take a step back from what your brain is telling you and say, hey, what is it that I'm actually seeing versus what I'm interpreting? And this can be something as simple as, you know, a glass of water. If you just see it sitting here, you could say, oh, someone left this glass of water. That's an interpretation. All you're seeing is a glass of water. Maybe someone placed this glass of water here for someone else. Maybe, you know, there are so many different possible ways of looking at it. You know, if you want to get all philosophical, half empty or half full, you know, all you know is that it's filled to this point. There's an objective measurement, but right away you're saying, oh, someone must have already drank half of it, or it was only filled halfway up. Both are interpretations. If we know that our brain has a tendency to do this, and it does, I mean, it always, this type of storytelling is really its natural state. If we know this, then we can try to always take a step back and say, hey, brain, are you telling me a story? Am I just making sense of things? Or am I really starting from a fresh slate? Mm-hmm. And if you're telling me a story, why are you telling me this story? And does it really follow from what I'm seeing? Maybe it does. Maybe the brain told you a very accurate story. Mm-hmm. But maybe it didn't. And there's really no way of knowing unless you learn to take a step back from your own thoughts. So mindfulness isn't just about being present in the moment in order to monitor your environment. It's also about being able to monitor yourself and your own thoughts.
Let's look at a second example then. I want to talk about how to be engaged. Mm-hmm. You actually use, as an example of one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, a story where Holmes is actually less than engaged, where he sort of lets himself down a bit, and that's the story of the stockbroker's clerk. So mm-hmm. let's talk about that example.
In that particular story, Holmes is looking at a man who has doubts about his employer. He starts suspecting that his employer might in fact be his employer's brother. He doesn't really know what's going on. There's clearly something weird. And Holmes right away realizes what the problem might be. So I don't want to give anything away, but he's basically solved the case in his mind based on what his client has told him. And in order to prove that he solved it, to kind of get the final piece of evidence, he accompanies him to his workplace to meet with this employer. Because he thinks that he's done and that this is really just a check mark, make the confrontation so that I can confirm that what I know is right, he loses his interest in the case. He becomes less engaged because he doesn't think anything will come of this interaction except for him saying, yes, I'm Sherlock Holmes and I was correct. And he's shocked when something else happens. So he comes and the employer is visibly distraught and then goes into another room and tries to commit suicide, and he almost dies, and that would really have ruined the plans altogether. An engaged Sherlock Holmes would have prevented that from happening because he would have seen the signs already, you know, the distraught nature of him, the fact that he was reading a newspaper and clearly something in the newspaper had upset him. These are all things that a Sherlockian Sherlock Holmes would have seen because they're very obvious clues. He misses them. He pays no attention to them. He becomes Watson for that visit because he's lost his engagement. And the only way, this goes back to motivation. I mean, the only way you can think like Sherlock Holmes is if you're motivated to think like Sherlock Holmes. And if you're Sherlock Holmes, you need to stay engaged. Motivation and engagement are very similar concepts. So if your mind isn't active, isn't interested, isn't really engaged in what you're doing, you will lose interest and you will, your attention will falter because those two things are intimately related. So Holmes shouldn't forgive himself for what happened. He almost botched a case because he was so confident in himself that he just forgot to pay attention. He didn't follow his own advice. He didn't know how many steps were leading up to Baker Street.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Maria Konnikova about her book Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Finally then, Maria, we come to a concept that is very familiar to fans of Sherlock Holmes, and this is the art of deduction. So let's talk briefly about, we're all familiar with the concept of deduction from Holmes, but let's talk about what it actually means.
So one thing that I do point out at the beginning of my discussion of deduction is that deduction in the sense of Holmesian deduction is not deduction in the formal logic sense. So because he doesn't just use deductive methods, he uses inductive methods, abductive methods. So if you're talking to a logician, we shouldn't call this deduction. But what it is using all of the information that you have, all of these facts and everything that you've done with them, all of the possible interpretations, and then going through them one by one to try to see which one is the one that will explain all of your observations. So you have a number of theories, you have a number of observations. Really, only one theory will fit all of the facts. And if it doesn't fit any of the facts, you have to throw it out. That's something that's very important, no matter how much you love it and how much of a pet theory it is. It has to explain everything.
To explain this, I mean, to illustrate that, you throw in a little fact at this point in the book yourself. You've talked throughout the book about how your father used to read Sherlock Holmes stories to you as you were growing up. But at this point, you mention that what seems like a surprise, when you first heard those stories, they were read to you in Russian. Now, of course, as you point out, you've laid the clues to that all the way through the book, and it shouldn't come as a surprise to readers if they're deducing as Holmes would.
I think that this really goes back to some of the points that we were also talking about earlier. You have preconceptions about everything. Conan Doyle is very British, and it's Sherlock Holmes is something that everyone associates with, you know, the English language. So even though I've been talking about, you know, being born in Russia, my parents being Russian, growing up in Russia, it's very easy to compartmentalize and to keep those facts separate from the fact of being read Conan Doyle stories, ergo being read them in English because Conan Doyle wrote in English. And especially because this book is written in English, it's very easy to just keep those two things separate and to never integrate them into a single whole. Now, to be fair, I never asked readers to do that until this chapter, but when I do ask, it's an interesting thing to note whether or not you've even caught the clues, or if they've really just been so compartmentalized that you don't even integrate them.
Mm-hmm.
And what Holmes's approach to deduction teaches you is to really make sure that everything is being integrated, that you're looking at the whole picture. One of the shortcomings of Lestrade and the other Scotland Yard detectives is they often don't. They're very selective in the facts that they choose to look at and in how they choose to look at those facts. And deduction also entails a lot of objectivity. And once again, telling your brain, bringing it back, rewinding it so that it stops making these assumptions, you know, Conan Doyle English, that it would make naturally.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. Our brain is a natural storyteller. I talk here about split brain patients as kind mm-hmm. of the extreme example of what our brain does all the time, which is confabulate and create reasons that really shouldn't be there.
I want to look a bit more closely at the split brain patients in a moment. Before we do, I just wanted to say, really, just as a, I guess, just as a statement, that also out of this, you know, the concept of deduction comes the other, you know, the really famous phrase of Sherlock Holmes, when all avenues are exhausted, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he says that in various ways, certainly at least two or three times, probably more throughout the stories, because it is such a crucial point for him, that the improbable isn't impossible. And that seems like it's a truism, and it is, but it's a truism that we need to repeat to ourselves
mm-hmm.
because we have a tendency to believe certain things that seem more believable more than we would believe things that seem less believable. And so we often do dismiss things out of hand because they seem improbable. And Holmes reminds us just how important it is to stay open-minded. And going back to the scientific method, the most brilliant scientists, the most brilliant breakthroughs, just imagine how open-minded they had to be. I mean, if Einstein weren't open-minded about the nature of, you know, the universe, he wouldn't have been able to conceive of these theories. All of the data pointed to it, so the improbable isn't impossible. It was improbable, but it ended up being true. A lot of other scientists could and did dismiss it out of hand, even after he published, because it seemed so wacky and tried to disprove it right away. And that happens with almost any new idea that is groundbreaking. You know, does the Earth really go around the sun, or are we the center of the universe? You know, everything seems improbable until it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's another truism. You know, that's what tends to happen to a lot of great ideas. And yet the process repeats over and over and over, no matter how many times we're told these stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because we think that everything that's at the limits of possibility is really all there is. I think it's, once again, if we go back to the context in which Conan Doyle was writing, I think one of the reasons that Sherlock Holmes has this mantra and is so good at keeping it up is that so many things were happening in Conan Doyle's time
mm-hmm.
that had seemed impossible 10 years prior, you know, the discovery of something like the X-ray. There were forces that we couldn't see, and yet that were incredibly powerful, these energy sources, these things that no one knew existed. You know, it was really kind of the birth of the invisible
mm-hmm.
bacteria that you can't see that can make you sick. All of these things were just basically seen as impossible beforehand. They were obviously merely improbable. So I think that that must have had some sort of effect on him, because he does stress it so often, and it is a huge part of deduction. We have to leave our brain open to look at all of the options and all of the possibilities, no matter how remote they may seem.
Mm-hmm. You alluded to an incredible experiment back a moment ago. You mentioned the concept of the split brain patients. So tell us about this. There's a couple of neuroscientists at Caltech, Roger Sperry and Michael Gazzaniga, and they performed this particular experiment. So tell us about, basically tell us the story of that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Roger Sperry was an incredibly brilliant scientist who worked with cats originally, and he worked with severing the corpus callosum, which is that network of fibers that connects the two hemispheres of our brain. So he would sever the corpus callosum of cats to see if that affected them, and it did. But at the time, people did not realize that severing the corpus callosum of humans would make any sort of meaningful difference to their experience of the world. This was a popular treatment for epilepsy, and I believe for some other diseases as well, but certainly for epilepsy, because there wasn't any visible change in the patient. Gazzaniga happened to be a student of Sperry's, and together they discussed the possibility that, well, why? We're not that different from cats. I mean, a lot of things that apply to animals apply to humans. That's
mm-hmm.
how a lot of psychological work is done. So why would it be that we'd see these striking effects in cats but not in humans? Is it really true that humans aren't affected as well?
Mm-hmm.
We thought, no, this can't be the case. no one's just figured out how to test it. And Gazzaniga had this brilliant insight that the reason that we can't test it is because we get inputs from both of our eyes to both sides of the brain. And so no one's ever tested a human in a condition where one side of the brain would really be unable to communicate with the other to see if this communication was permanently severed. And so he created this machine where you would only get inputs to one side of each eye. So the way that vision works is the opposite hemisphere processes the input from where it's coming. So right is processed by left hemisphere, left is processed by right. But it's also true that your eyes are divided in half. Mm-hmm. And so it's the right and left side of each eye. And so he created an experiment where you would see something presented and it would really be only presented to one hemisphere of the brain and not to the other. And what he realized was the brain isn't talking to each other. There are these really strong repercussions that no one has been able to catch before. So if I show you a picture of, the famous picture is a chicken foot and a snowplow, and if I show the chicken foot to one side of the brain that can verbalize, it will say chicken foot. If I show it to the other side, I'll say I didn't see anything. And yet if I have you point to a picture, you will point to the right picture because you're processing it in a different way. But you will have no conscious memory of having seen the snowplow picture at all. But if I ask you, you know, why did you point to these two pictures, you'll create a story about how you need to shovel up the chicken coop or something like that so these two pictures go together. So you can really see something and have no conscious memory of seeing it and yet be able to tell a story about why your brain registered it, because it clearly did register it. And so in these studies, they showed several things. One, the corpus callosum really is the communication center between the two hemispheres. They really do stop communicating after this is severed. And so one side can't verbalize what it saw. Mm-hmm. It has no idea. And yet it has registered it on some deeper level. And the other thing is that our brains tell stories. So we find it impossible to think that we don't know why we're acting in certain ways. And we truly believe in our explanations. So we create these narratives right away. You know, one of the things was he had shown someone a glass of water and then they went to get water and they said, oh no, I suddenly just felt thirsty, you know. Or someone started laughing because there was an inappropriate picture, but they didn't know they saw the inappropriate picture. Mm-hmm. But they then said, what was so funny about the experiment? This has been shown in so many different contexts. And it's really just taking what the normal brain does to an extreme. This confabulation, these stories, that even if I then told you, no, that's not the reason you're doing it, this is why you're doing it, you're not going to believe me, because you're going to say, no, of course I have access to my own thoughts, I know why I'm doing these things. You don't.
That discussion comes out of a chapter which, to massively simplify it, is looking at the difficulty of sorting out relevant from irrelevant information that we experience in the world. And I'd like to look at the difficulty of that, or I'd like to look at how we can do that, again, through the prism of one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, which happens to be my favourite one, which is Silver Blaze, the story of the missing racehorse. So let's talk about what we can learn from how to sort out relevant from irrelevant information from Silver Blaze.
Or the crucial from the incidental, yes, if we borrow the phrase from Holmes. In Silver Blaze, it's one of my favourites as well, probably my favourite. And the problem here is one of too much, not too little information. So at the beginning of the case, Holmes has all of this information from the media, from the investigators, from everyone, and everyone's been talked to, someone's been arrested. You know, there's just this mass of information. And so here, whereas a lot of other cases start with almost no information and you have to start gathering it, here the sorting is incredibly important, because if everything is just in one big undifferentiated mass, you're going to weigh everything equally, you're not going to know how to proceed. What Holmes understands is that we need to learn how to weigh these things, how to sort the crucial from the merely incidental. And it goes back to setting up the proper kind of framework and knowing how to be selective, you know, what things matter for your goal, in this particular case, finding the horse. And to do that, he understands that there are different levels of information. There's the information from the scene, kind of the objective information that we know. There's everything that he knows from the reporters. There's everything he knows from the investigators. That's already been filtered, so that might not be quite as crucial because we want to sweep away all of that. Even he is taken in at first, because so strong is that tendency to listen to narratives. that it's easy to see those things as facts that are to be weighed equally. So in the case of Silver Blaze, it's a fact that this man came the night of the horse's disappearance and tried to bribe the stable boy. It's no longer a fact that he had anything to do with the disappearance, but because it's already presented as a fait accompli, he's been arrested, his scarf was found on the scene, all of the circumstantial evidence, you might not be able to separate it right away, and Holmes doesn't. It takes him a while to kind of start sifting through everything. Once again, it's not quite so simple. It does take a lot of hard work. But once he realizes, you know, what is the framework, who are the principal actors, what am I looking for, it helps him, in a way, make mental lists of, you know, what buckets can I put this stuff into, that starts to put the information into some semblance of logic. You know, things related to missing horse, things related to missing trainer, things related to night of the murder, things related to stable boy, you know, things related to wife, source, where is it coming from, the scene, the stable boy himself, the wife herself, the inspector, the colonel whose horse is missing, you know, the reporter who wrote the original story that I read in the newspaper. And from that, you can start to see which squares light up, you know, where the facts seem like these are going to be the important things to look at.
We live now in a time where there's a lot more irrelevant information, and we're constantly bombarded with far more imagery and just stuff than would have been in the times of Sherlock Holmes. And I was taken by one of the ways you talk about as being able to adopt a more sort of Sherlockian way of thinking. You talk about the importance of the quiet mind. So just tell me briefly what you mean by that.
I mean a mind that is able to separate itself from the distractions of the world. We can't expect the world to change for us. It won't. And as technology becomes omnipresent, as we become kind of tethered to these different devices all the time, that's not going to change. I mean, if anything, it's going to get worse. Mm-hmm. And so we have to take responsibility for our own minds and for how we react to them, so we can make a conscious decision. Am I going to check my cell phone every 3 seconds? Am I going to be writing a text while I'm walking? Am I going to be doing, you know, these multiple things at once? Or am I going to manage myself more effectively? Am I going to be able to filter out the distractions and focus on just what I'm doing, on my thoughts, on the present moment? Am I going to be able to quiet my own mind? Because the environment is never going to quiet down for me. I have to consciously make the effort to quiet it down. And that's really just an attitude. It's much easier to blame technology and to say, oh, well, you know, it's just the world and the way the world is making me. The only person to blame is yourself, and we're the only ones who can make any difference in how we respond to that technology.
Just to finish off then, we've been talking about Sherlock Holmes and John Watson throughout this interview, I guess as if they were real people, they're fictional characters. So I guess really we're talking about the mind and the imagination of Arthur Conan Doyle, the man that created them, and as well as being the creator of Sherlock Holmes, that famous paragon of rationality, he was quite a fallible man himself. He was a hardcore spiritualist, and he famously fell for the Cottingley Fairies hoax, an incident that you look at length in the book. So these incidents themselves demonstrate how difficult it is to maintain a sort of Holmesian outlook throughout our lives.
Yeah, especially when we really want to believe something. We spoke at the beginning of the interview about the difficulty of skepticism and the ease of credulity of believing everything that's taken in, because that's the way that our brains are normally set up. Well, multiply that by a million when we want to believe something. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a million biases that then come into play, the confirmation bias, where we only look at confirming information. We become much less thorough when we want to believe something, when really we should become much more thorough, much more skeptical. And Conan Doyle desperately wanted to believe the fairies were real, because in the war he'd lost a number of family members, children, and I think he really, you know, it really shook him. He wanted to feel like he could connect to them, that there were these other dimensions that were outside of our understanding. He took Holmes's open-mindedness a step further, because I think what Holmes would say is, okay, don't discount the existence of fairies, don't discount spiritualism. He was even willing to entertain in The Count of the Baskervilles the possibility that the hound may be non-human, that he may be a devil hound, supernatural. But he says it's much more likely that he has human agents. So, yes, don't discount it, but make sure that your burden of proof is that much higher, instead of indulging your natural tendency, which is making it that much lower. On the other hand, I don't want to judge Conan Doyle too harshly, because this is a common tendency, and also because in terms of spirituals, in terms of the fairies, I mean, I want to judge him harshly. That was pretty ridiculous. But in terms of spiritualism, we do have to put it in the context of the time and judge him on the terms of the time and not on our own terms. And we should remember that William James, who's the father of modern psychology, was a spiritualist. He thought that the future of psychology was in spiritualism. So there were a lot of really prominent thinkers who thought at that stage that spiritualism might be a very real thing. And of course there were skeptics. Harry Houdini, you know, very famously, had a fell out with Arthur Conan Doyle over spiritualism. But I would like a little bit of indulgence for him here.
I think we can do that. So that's a great point for us to end on. So I've been talking to Maria Konnikova. We've been talking about Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, which is out now from Canongate Books. So, Maria, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Ken Plume, and you've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to donate a little money to help support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.